content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Kogal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Glamour Magazine, as well as a bit from the New York Times Kids Magazine. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached by kiwanisfoundation.org. Well, welcome back, everyone. Today is Thursday, the 21st of February. We're getting close to the 21st of March, which is, you know what day? Spring. All right. But before we get there, we've got a lot of things to cover. And one of them is quite an interesting article, actually. It's from the Glamour magazine. And it's entitled, I Got a Mastectomy, Twice. When my plastic surgeon called, I wasn't surprised. He was old school, the type of doctor who was inclined to check in on a patient, especially when it came to a difficult case like mine. This call came after my fourth breast reconstruction, after a nipple-sparing prophylactic mastectomy, and 6 months of expanders, a pair of silicone implants, had been placed in my chest. Months later, my body rejected the implants, prompting multiple complications and more visits to the operating room. This new surgeon was my second opinion, and I'd hoped he might have another approach that would help my body acclimate to the implants. Our conversation started like this. We found something when we opened you up. I was sure he was about to tell me I had breast cancer, the dagger I'd been trying to avoid. But what he said next was even more startling. I had residual breast tissue that needed to be examined. Then he said I might need a completion mastectomy. I sat frozen, turning the doctor's words over in my head. After genetic testing revealed I'm a BRCA1 mutation carrier, that's the BRCA1, it's the breast cancer gene, meaning my risk of getting the disease was about 72%, I'd been closely monitored for several years. My doctor had implored me to be vigilant about alternating breast MRIs and mammograms every 6 months. After 4 years, I opted for an even safer choice, having my breasts removed altogether. I knew the mastectomy would drastically lower my odds of getting breast cancer. So what did this mean for my odds now? The disease had haunted my family ever since my aunt was diagnosed in 1995. 7 years later, when I was a newlywed, my mom discovered a lump, and her stage 2 cancer was treated aggressively with chemotherapy and radiation. Both of these strong women survived, but the knowledge that I could follow in their footsteps loomed large. This personal connection motivated me to report passionately on breast cancer, much the way a war correspondent covers atrocities abroad. As a journalist, I wrote many stories as I could, covering mammography guidelines and what the experience of going through breast cancer feels like. I'd fought back tears as brave women, many of whom weren't as lucky as my mom and my aunt, shared their stories with me. A few days after my doctor's call, I met with a new breast surgeon who also raised the subject of a completion mastectomy. In all my years of reporting, I'd never heard of such a thing. During my breast exam, if you can call it that, since by that point I'd already had 3 sets of silicone implants, the surgeon had me pressed down on the pillowy flesh in my cleavage. There it was, the last vestiges of my own tissue. Two things I knew from my investigative work. The smallest cell can lead to a malignancy. 1 cubic centimeter of tissue can contain 1 billion cells. Also, a prophylactic mastectomy doesn't guarantee you won't get breast cancer. The risk after a prophylactic mastectomy, where there was no cancer in the breast to begin with, is under 3%, says Christy Frank, MD, a board-certified breast cancer surgeon and co-founder of the Pink Lotus Breast Cancer Breast Center in Beverly Hills. The average woman has about a 12.4% risk, so under 3% is vastly lower than average, which is why I had felt safe. I hadn't had a mammogram or an MRI in 18 months. Now my old fears were back. I was hysterical at the thought that I might have cancer cells lurking in my chest. The doctor performed a manual exam and, thankfully, found no lumps. Across town at the radiologist's office, an ultrasound also showed no masses. Still, to be completely safe, I planned another surgery. After the procedure, biopsies of my leftover tissues showed no signs of malignant cells. I felt grateful and then apoplectic to find myself in this position yet again, with my husband tending to my incisions, emptying my drains, and washing my hair in the kitchen sink, both of us trying to stay strong for our son. There's no hard data on how many mastectomy patients need a completion surgery. When we counsel patients about mastectomies, we tell them that we don't remove all of the breast tissue, says Carla Fisher, MD, Director of Breast Surgery, and an Associate Professor of Surgery at the Indiana University School of Medicine. The goal is to remove all of the breast tissue, but the way the anatomy of the breast is, you cannot say you're removing every single last cell. The residual amount is usually 2 to 5% of what was initially there, she says. While on some level I knew this, after all I was aware that prophylactic mastectomy wouldn't eliminate my chance of getting breast cancer, the fact that I had to undergo a completion procedure still left me reeling. Needless to say, it's been a grueling journey for me, but after 2 mastectomies, I finally feel confident that I've done as much as I can to stay cancer-free. Still, this experience taught me a lot. Here are some things I think every woman should know. Mastectomies aren't magic. Because of women like Angela Jolie and others, we think this surgery, while drastic, will allow a woman who is a BRCA mutation carrier to forever sidestep cancer. Even though doctors routinely explain this is not the case, it's easy to still believe the myth. I was lucky that my implant complications drove me to seek a second opinion. If my reconstruction had gone along swimmingly, I might not have learned about my remaining breast tissue unless it turned cancerous. Research your doctor. Dr. Funk recommends choosing a surgeon with a subspecialty in breast surgery, especially if you're high risk. Not everyone can do so, if you live in a rural area, for example. But every expert I spoke to recommended it. It's crucial to pick a surgical team where mastectomies and reconstruction is their forte, says Dr. Funk. Assuming the option exists, you want to go to a high-volume person or center that does lots of them. Ask lots and lots of questions. Find out what kind of incision will be best for you and your breast size and shape. Dr. Funk says she always raises this issue with patients. It can be harder for a surgeon to reach all the tissue in larger-breasted women with certain incision types, for example. Ask whether any of your cosmetic concerns will impact how much tissue is left or what your risk of cancer might be post-surgery. If your doctor doesn't address these issues, make sure you bring them up. Don't stop screening. There are no official guidelines for screening after a prophylactic mastectomy, but you should always feel for lumps and bumps, just as you did with your non-surgical pair. Staying vigilant is crucial, especially for me and my fellow BRCA mutation carriers. Do this if only for your peace of mind, which is inexorably altered when you learn that, by a genetic defect in your family tree, you're marked for cancer. Some of my BRCA patients may have a hard time feeling totally secure that their risk is so low that they no longer need monitoring for breast cancer, Dr. Funk says. That's why I have them pop in once a year. I do a skin exam with my hands, and I ultrasound them up into their armpits, into their nodes. It makes them feel immensely more protected. The biggest thing my scars have taught me, you can't predict what will happen. Instead of wallowing in what could have been, I've made a promise to myself to march forward and help as many other women as I can. I know I've done my best to prevent cancer, and if my experience couldn't break my determination, nothing will. Lambeth Hochwald is a writer in New York City and an adjunct professor of journalism at New York University. So, something to think about. Okay, so we're going to head on over to the New York Times Kids magazine here. And because February is the month of love, really, with Valentine's Day, of course, we're going to be reading about kids who have made a difference. These are kids of all ages, most of them, oh, I don't know, I guess 15, 16, 17, 18 years old, something like that. And we're going to go through just quite a few of these because they are unbelievable, the things that some kids have done. It's really cool. So here's Grayson Shear. He makes sure foster kids know they matter. Grayson knows a lot about life in foster care, like how kids in the system often must travel from home to home without many clothes or their own bag for their stuff. "I know how it feels to carry all your belongings in a trash bag," says Grayson, whose parents adopted him, his older sister, and his brothers out of foster care in 2011. "It makes you feel disposable." In 2013, Grayson and his family, who live in Darnestown, Maryland, started ComfortCases.org, an organization that provides sturdy bags filled with necessities like warm pajamas and toothbrushes for foster kids. Grayson helps by packing and delivering cases. One day last month, his dad got a call about four kids in the area who had arrived in foster care with nothing but the clothes they wore. "They were my age and my brother's age," Grayson says, "and all I could think about was making them feel better." He dropped what he was doing and drove with his dad to their warehouse, where he packed up four cases for them. "I put double of everything in. Still," Grayson says, "it's not just about the material things. It's to show that somebody loves them." All right. Now, here is Lilia Montiel. She wants a peaceful sleep for everyone. When Lilia learned that one of her dad's students had been bitten by something while sleeping on the floor because he didn't have a bed, she decided to do something about it. She started ZZZ's, the number 4, KIDZ. So Z's for kids, to give beds, including a frame, a mattress, and bedding, to children whose parents can't afford them. What really made me want to do this is that sleep can improve so many people's academic and personal success, she says. So far, with the help of a GoFundMe page and a local furniture store in San Diego, she has handed out 14 new beds. Her ultimate goal, to provide 1,000 kids with a cozy place to sleep. All right, how about Jaquiel Jackson, who hands out blessing bags? Early one morning last December, Jaquiel's mom woke him up with some big news. President Obama was tweeting about him. He had named Jaquiel one of 2017's most influential people for his work helping the homeless. It's a mission Jaquiel has been working on since age 5, when his aunt took him to hand out food to people living on the streets of Chicago. I wanted to do something about it, he says. He and his family came up with blessing bags, care packages for homeless people that include necessities like towels, deodorant, and winter gear. When Jaquiel's family first handed the bags out at shelters, they thought it would be a one-time thing. 3 years later, he now holds assembly line-style packing parties at least once a month, with up to 50 volunteers, and he accepts donations via his nonprofit, Project I Am. In February, he even got to meet Obama, who Jaquiel says was pretty funny and cool. In total, he has handed out more than 19,000 bags across places including Chicago, Los Angeles, and Atlanta. And his goal for 2019 is 15,000, a number that seems to scare his mother. But that doesn't faze him at all. All right, how about Paloma Rambana, who fights for kids with vision impairment? Paloma was born with a rare condition called Peter's anomaly, which makes it hard for her to see. That made learning in a classroom tricky. 80% of learning occurs through vision, she says. When she was in kindergarten, a government program for visually impaired kids paid for her to have a vision teacher and learning tools like a closed-circuit television, CCTV, which Paloma could use to magnify text. But that program only covered kids ages 3 through 5. After that, my parents had to fund all of my tools, Paloma says, including buying a new CCTV, which can cost up to $3,000. That's not something everyone can afford. In 2015, she asked the Florida legislature to create a vision resources program for kids ages 6 to 13. A federal program already covers ages 14 to 22. When she met with legislators, she brought her iPad and magnifier, which her parents paid for, and shared her story about how these tools made it possible for her to learn. 3 months later, she and her fellow advocates were able to secure $1.25 million to start the children's program. I definitely want to continue helping blind and visually impaired people, Paloma says. That's a big objective in my future. All right. All right, well, we've got a little article on family drama. captured in one photo. Family photos can be funny, silly, awkward, or just plain weird, especially when they're snapshots of people who aren't even related. Each year, world leaders from 19 countries in the European Union get together for the Group of 20 Leaders Summit, where they talk about the global economy and other big international issues like climate change and agree to work together on certain policies. This year, it was held on November 30th and December 1 in Buenos Aires, Argentina. That is, last year it was. At the end, the leaders pose for an official family photo, quote-unquote. As with many families, there is often a lot of drama going on behind the scenes that the camera does not capture. 1. Donald Trump and Xi Jinping. President Trump is the wild card in this family, since he is not especially popular in many countries. But the leader of the United States is always front and center in the G20 photo. This year, Trump had dinner with China's president, Xi Jinping. The two ate steak and agreed to try to stop fighting over trade. Trump said the two had a wonderful and very warm dinner, quote-unquote, and announced a three-month pause in their trade war, which was big news. Well, check out the news today. All right. 2. Enrique Peña Nieto and Justin Trudeau. President Enrique Peña Nieto of Mexico and Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of Canada met with President Trump to sign a new trade deal among their countries, which took months and a lot of fighting before an agreement was reached. Although Trudeau is smiling, he was not very happy with Trump, who refused to stop charging Canada a fee to send shipments of steel and aluminum into the United States. Peña Nieto was also upset that the fees were not lifted. He won't be in next year's photo because Mexico elected a new president. 3. Theresa May and Jean-Claude Juncker. The tension was high between Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May and Jean-Claude Juncker, or Juncker, the president of the European Commission. May is making plans for her country to leave the European Union, a group of 28 countries in Europe that work together as if they were one giant country. If Britain does exit the Union, things are going to be messy. Britain will need to negotiate completely new agreements so that its businesses and citizens can still trade, travel, and work in countries outside of Britain. And then 4, Vladimir Putin. The Russian leader was not very popular at this G20. Trump canceled his private dinner with Putin because of Russia's refusal to release Ukrainian ships and sailors on a shared waterway, a decision that made Putin angry. The two leaders did eventually have a brief chat during the two-day event, but it was frosty. And finally, 5, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The black sheep of the family this year was Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, who was pushed to the fringes, both in the photo and at the event itself. The crown prince was largely shunned by other world leaders because a Saudi journalist was murdered, and the CIA concluded that bin Salman ordered the killing. The crown prince did find one family member to pal around with. Bin Salman and Putin greeted each other with a high five during the event. All right, and in French schools, cell phones are illegal. Most rules in French schools are the same as in American ones. No fights in the cafeteria, no rude words to your teachers, no cell phones in class. That last one, though, it's the law in France. In September, the government banned phones in all primary and middle schools. Under the new law, students can still bring their phones to school, but they must keep them in their bags or in lockers. They can't take them out during lunch or recess either. And the government has ordered teachers to confiscate phones for one day if the law is broken. It's literally the law. The French education minister who implemented the ban says he hopes students will pay more attention in class and will interact more with each other. It's a message we send to society, he says. Do not always be on your phones. Matisse Montigny, 14, who goes to school in a suburb of Paris, says he and his friends have been communicating more during recess and other breaks since the ban went into effect. We play more table tennis or table soccer, and teachers play more with us too, Matisse says. A friend liked to play on his phone a lot. He was a little addicted, but now he talks more to us. Smartphones can have negative effects, like distracting you and preventing you from interacting with others. Researchers have even found an effect they call brain drain. Just having a phone around, even if you're not using it, can reduce your brain's capacity because you're using energy to resist the urge to be on it. Some kids, of course, don't like the ban and argue that phones are part of everyday life. The ban has been really annoying, says Grace Blaharou, a 13-year-old in Paris. If I don't have my phone with me or near me, I'm stressed out. I feel like there is something missing in me. All right, so no cell phones. They're illegal in France. Okay, hey, did you do that puzzle I gave you last week, the crossword puzzle? I'm going to give you the answers, okay? See if you got them. One across, wipe the dishes after they've been washed. iPad. All right, and then one down, pull along the ground is I-D-O. And then two down, sushi ingredient is pilot, P-I-L-O-T. And three, time period of being a kid down is anime. And four down, Okay, we're actually going to do this in a different way. I'm going to just read all the words across, and that way you'll have all of the words. So starting from the top, it should be dry, riots, Acura, get up, and he's, H-E-S. All right. Well, we have reached the end of our program for today of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Aniko Gal, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. Today's programming is underwritten with support from the Raleigh Kiwanis Foundation. They can be reached by Kiwanisfoundation.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919 832